Should members of Congress have to feel the financial pain of a government shutdown? This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, a proposal to tax lawmakers when they can't keep the federal government funded. Plus, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine takes aim at intoxicating hemp, riverboat fans flock to the riverfront, and Bengals fans wonder what this new Joe will mean for the season. Joining me now to get our news review started are Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Laura Bischoff and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Laura and Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Joe, let's start with you. Senator Bernie Moreno has proposed a bill that would tax members of Congress during a government shutdown. How would that work?
Well, basically what it would do, it's called the Stop Holding Up Taxpayers Act, and it would assess a $500 tax on each representative, each senator, for daily sessions that are missed due to a government shutdown. He thinks the shutdown is grossly irresponsible and that lawmakers are not doing their jobs. And, you know, up in on Capitol Square right now, the House has been sent home. They're not having sessions. So the Senate has been having sessions this week. But he says his bill doesn't violate the 27th Amendment to the Constitution that bans current members from raising or lowering their salaries. And he says that he thinks that this is fair and it would way in the back of these lawmakers' minds when they are in a situation like they're in right now.
And it sounds like this would apply to Republicans and Democrats, everybody in there.
It would apply to everyone. He said that, you know, basically Republicans, even though they control the House, they control the Senate, they control the White House, they need some Democrats to come on board. And he said they've got to have the help of these Democrats. He says he wished that he had all Republicans to work with, but he needs the Democrats. And because that's the case, there has to be a willingness to try to work with them. And so that's the whole purpose behind his proposal.
Well, President Trump has said this shutdown could lead to more permanent cuts. What did Senator Moreno have to say about that?
Well, you know, he did say that they've already made some cuts. But he says if this goes on for a long period of time, there won't be a choice. That Congress has appropriated a set amount of money to fund about 20 to 25% of the discretionary budget of the United States. So that means that if you land in that 20 to 25% in services, they're going to have to shut it down. And he said there's not really a choice beyond this point.
Have services in Ohio been affected yet by the shutdown?
Not so much. Little things have. But I talked with Governor DeWine recently. I asked him about that. And he said, you know, initially, we're not seeing a huge problem in Ohio. But he said, give it a couple of weeks. And that's when all this discretionary money that Senator Moreno's talking about, that's where it comes into play. And it could very well be that in a couple of weeks, we start to see the fallout from all of this.
Well, speaking of Governor DeWine, Laura, what are these hemp products the governor is concerned about?
Well, the governor decided to put on an executive order for 90 days that would ban what he's calling intoxicating hemp products. He's focused a lot on candy, things that look like candy, gummies sold in gas stations and convenience stores that are in packages that mimic candies like Sour Patch or Nerds or what have you. And they have a very high THC content. THC is the ingredient that makes you get you high. He held up a package of candies that with each gummy had 100 milligrams of THC, which is a lot. And so he's decided to go through an executive order and ban these things, probably put some pressure on the legislature to decide how to regulate, if at all. But what's interesting is that there's a lot of people, you know, businesses that say that they are responsible actors in this market, and they are producing and selling THC-infused seltzers with maybe 5 to 10 milligrams per serving. And these are big companies like Artifact Brewing and Seventh Son here in Columbus. You know, they think that this was, instead of using a scalpel to kind of carve them out and allow them to continue operating, they feel like the governor is using an axe to solve this problem.
So does his order include both these edible products and drinks? I mean, it sounds like he's saying these edible products, these gummies, are kind of deliberately deceptive sometimes in their packaging and really strong. But does it, is that part of the argument, and does it include both?
It does include both. It's a blanket ban. And I think the governor, his point is, look, the Ohio voters endorsed a marijuana program that is highly regulated, that uses products that are sold and packaged, grown, sold and packaged in Ohio. And it's taxed, it's tested. And this is not that. These THC drinks and these gummies and the rest of it are coming in from all over the place. They're not necessarily facing the same tax level as the marijuana dispensaries face, and that this is not what the voters endorsed.
Okay, question for you, Laura. I think a lot of us, when we think about hemp, and the governor is talking about these products as intoxicating hemp, but I think a lot of us, when we think about hemp, think of something that has very low levels of THC. Do you know what the story is there?
Yes, I found that out this week while I was reporting on this. Hemp is very low level THC normally, but what they're doing is they're taking the hemp and they're putting it in a lab and they're tweaking it and really ramping up the THC content and then creating these different products. And it's a loophole in the 2018 federal farm law that has allowed this to happen, where hemp is considered legal and they don't redefine hemp that has been kind of ramped up on the THC content level.
Hmm. So with this order that the governor signed, how quickly were stores that sell these products or even bars, I guess, required to get them off their shelves and their menus?
They have until 12:01 a.m. Tuesday. So there's a lot of shops and manufacturers and the rest of it that are trying to clear their inventory as much as they can between now and, the end of Monday.
Clearing it by selling it, I guess, huh?
Right. It's interesting because the governor said, well, they can just send it back to the manufacturer for a refund. I'm not sure how that is supposed to work.
Yeah. Does the governor have the authority to do this? Can he sign an executive order that has this kind of impact?
Well, I mean, initially he said he didn't think he had the authority. And then he said this week that he went back to his legal team and they said, yeah, actually, you do have the authority. This is already there's been one lawsuit filed, maybe two, challenging him on that. So we'll see. It's like I said, it's 90 days, a 90-day order. And then after that, he can't renew it and it'll be up to the lawmakers. The lawmakers could renew the order by resolution, I'm told.
Hmm. Well, and you mentioned, the governor has been asking state lawmakers to take action on these products like for quite a while. Why haven't they? Why haven't state lawmakers done anything about this?
Well, I think in a lot of cases, the lawmakers can't come to an agreement because they, it's hard work to figure out what the best solution is to a tough problem like this.
So what's next with this? Where does this leave retailers? Do you expect lawmakers to take this up?
I mean, if passed as prologue, then no, the lawmakers will not take it up. And the retailers, might be kind of out of luck.
Okay. Well, let's go back to you, Joe, and this is related to state lawmakers. What's the latest with Ohio's congressional redistricting process? Has the Ohio Redistricting Commission met yet?
Not yet. But we are told by both the Senate president and also by Governor DeWine that they expect something will be happening soon and that there probably will be a meeting of the Ohio Redistricting Commission called in the coming days. There's no timetable on when that's going to happen. We don't know how many meetings are going to happen. We still don't have a map, Republican map. The map that was put out by Democrats early in the process, in that first part of the process, was summarily rejected. And the Republicans don't have a map. And Speaker Matt Huffman says the reason they don't have a map is that there's no kind of working behind the scenes to come to agreements on a basis for it.
The commission, you mentioned there's no word on when these meetings will happen, but the commission does have a deadline for approving a new map, right?
They do. They've got to do it this month. And if they don't do it this month, then it goes to the full legislature where Republicans are a supermajority. So if it goes to the legislature, they can pass a partisan map without the help of a single Democrat. And if that happens, that map is a 6-year map that stays in place until 2031. And then you go back through this whole process again at that time.
Any word on whether Republican state lawmakers will try to create a more Republican leaning districts like state lawmakers in Texas did?
Well, you know, that's been discussed. And I know that U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno has gone on record, saying that he'd like to see a map that's much more Republican, maybe 12-3 or 13-2, maybe. So far, we haven't seen a map, so we don't know what they're working with. The current map is 10-5, and there's a couple of districts in there that Republicans thought, I think, that they had a good chance of winning, and Democrats won them by very small margins. So typically, it could be a 12-3 map if it was just tweaked a little bit.
Well, Laura, I want to come back to you on a very sobering note, and that's that the number of Ohioans killed in domestic violence cases reached the highest documented number in a decade. Tell us about those numbers, what they are, and what are the reasons behind that increase?
Yeah, this is a report from the Ohio Domestic Violence Network, which is a statewide group. They've been collecting data for 10 years, and this is the highest they've seen. It's a 38% increase over the previous 12 months. And it's Ohio, because it's a very local control state, there's no quick and easy database of all the police reports to search. And so the Domestic Violence Network spends a lot of time culling through news reports and doing public records reports, and then also looking at police reports. So it's inexact, but it's pretty good. And they think that there's been better reporting of these cases, but also an increase in violence. And one of the things that they're seeing is that there's a strong link to access to guns. In 84% of these deaths, guns were used.
So are they saying that link is kind of a way that more lives could be saved if there wasn't that kind of access?
Yeah, I mean, they said that if they had kept guns away from people with domestic violence histories or protection orders, that at least 100 people could have been saved. Another really shocking part of this is that in those cases, 36 children were present when a killing took place. And these deaths left 92 kids without one or both parents.
Talk to us about some more of those data points in that report. They had quite a list.
Yeah, in like 35% of the cases, the relationship had just ended or was ending. So that's really indicative of that's a kind of a pivot point, a really dangerous point when these violent episodes can take place. People of color are overrepresented. They're 56% of the primary victims were people of color. And there were 40 cases involving murder suicides, and another 4 cases of attempted murder suicides were documented. And in 43 of 44 of those cases, guns were involved.
What is the impact of these kinds of cases for first responders?
Oh, I mean, it's super dangerous. It's probably one of the most dangerous calls that first responders can get, is to go to a domestic violence situation. It's just incredibly volatile. And last year, Morrow County, I guess earlier this year in May, Morrow County Sheriff's Deputy Daniel Shear was shot and killed on a domestic violence call in Marengo. He was only 31 years old.
Are there places in the state where most of these fatalities occur?
It's not surprising. It's where people live. Franklin County had the highest number with 33, Cuyahoga at 20, and Hamilton County had 11.
Well, I appreciate knowing that you're reporting as awful as those numbers are. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Laura Bischoff and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Yeah, thank you, Lucy.
Up next, organizers for America's River Roots Festival ask Hamilton County for more funding. This is Cincinnati Edition. There were 2 attempts to bring back Cincinnati's beloved Tall Stacks Festival. It never happened. But now the riverboats are lining the shores of the Ohio River once again. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. America's River Roots Festival continues in Cincinnati and Newport. Joining me now to talk about the festival is WVXU environment reporter Isabel Nisley. Welcome back, Isabel.
Thanks, Lucy.
And WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzel is with us, too. He's going to update us on a local lawsuit involving a national landlord. Thanks for being here, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
We're going to start with you, Isabel. A lot of people remember Tall Stacks. I know I took my daughters there. I did some reporting on it. It was a festival that celebrated Cincinnati's riverboat history. Now we have America's River Roots Festival. Is this festival in any way connected to Tall Stacks?
In character, absolutely. These are both celebrations of all things river cities, all things riverboats, like you said. And America's River Roots is officially the kickoff of America's 250th anniversary celebration, whereas the first Tall Stacks was the kickoff to Cincinnati's 200th anniversary celebration. So some similarities there, and it definitely seems like festival goers are picking up on those connections. A lot of people are excited to see a Tall Stacks-like event returning to the riverfront.
That is exciting. You talked to people attending the festival earlier this week, including a very young steamboat fan.
I really like things that have steam and they were from a long time ago.
Tell us about that little person and that little person's parents.
Yeah, so that was Edo Berkey. He's an elementary schooler from Fort Mitchell, Kentucky. Him and his parents, Mary and Dan, came down to the riverfront. It was fall break for the kiddo. Parents had off work. And like he said, they are really interested in steamboats. Usually they'll check out the model one at the Cincinnati Museum Center, but they were really impressed by just the sheer number of riverboats that were along the river that day. There are 10, and they came from 7 cities, including New Orleans, Pittsburgh, and even St. Paul.
Wow, I bet they look so big to such a little person, too.
I'm sure.
Yeah. You also spoke to a gentleman with memories of Tall Stacks.
The big ones like the Delta Queen, Delta Queen's in dry dock, Mississippi Queen went out of business, American Queen's not coming here. The big boats, they can't make it financially, so they've kind of dropped out.
Tell us about him.
Yeah, that was America's River Roots volunteer, Jeff Cook. He says he went to nearly every Tall Stacks Festival. I think he said he missed the first one, but after that, he was there at all of them. And he said the steamboats really draw him there every time. Although the big boats that he mentioned really, really liking aren't necessarily there this time, he's still going to take a cruise later on in the week, and he's looking forward to that.
Yeah, my understanding is the COVID pandemic was really tough on some of those bigger boats and their businesses. You also ran into some people who even dressed historically.
Did you dance at all on the boat?
Yes, we did. But we had to time travel a little bit because they were doing 20s and 30s and 40s music. And of course, we were in 1801, 1800. But luckily, we were able to transport ourselves forward in time to do the correct steps. Somehow, we just knew what to do to the New Orleans jazz.
Tell us about these ladies. It sounds like they were having fun.
Oh, yeah. They were having a blast. They're all connected through this Flying Cloud Academy of Vintage Dance. So this is their passion. This is their friendship. You heard the voice of Ruth Ann Wolf there, but she was, you know, in her group of friends, and they'd just taken a cruise on the Steamboat Natchez, and they were wearing Regency-era dresses. So clothing from the time when riverboats had started to be constructed. So they were really kind of playing into the historical nature of the festival.
Yeah, those dresses look hot, too. It's good that it cooled off for them for this whole thing. Clearly, you talked to people who were having lots of fun, who were enjoying the festival, but there were some features of this festival that had to be canceled, right?
Yeah, you're right. Back in September, America's River Roots canceled its music headliners. These were national acts like Weezer, Janelle Monáe, and Mountjoy, who were supposed to perform as part of the festival. But organizers said they had to cancel those performances, which were ticketed, because of, I think they quoted, a changing entertainment landscape. And our news partner at WCPO also reported that poor ticket sales played into that decision to cancel. Mm.
So where's the money coming from for this festival and putting it on? These things are expensive to do. Are the city and county helping to fund it?
Yeah, so America's River Roots has a number of corporate sponsors. It's also being produced in collaboration with America's 250th Commission and several other local governments. And the city of Cincinnati and Hamilton County have both provided funding for the event. Cincinnati gave $450,000 to River Roots through two grants over the past 2 years. And Hamilton County has given $350,000 to the festival. That was before yesterday, when they approved an additional $150,000 for the festival to help them pay for additional costs for the event.
So what did county commissioners have to say about allocating that additional money?
Yes, the commissioner said that America's River Roots came to the county to ask for additional funds, and commission president Denise Driehaus says she was initially hesitant about the festival's ask, but she was willing to support it since it's related to economic development. Driehaus says she's hopeful the event brings in economic activity to the region, you know, through sales tax, through hotel tax, things like that, and she said because of that, it's important that it goes off without a hitch. And Commissioner, the vice president, also expressed a little bit of hesitancy, but they both ended up approving the additional funding.
So where is the festival happening for people who want to go? Can you kind of give us a lay of the land a little bit?
Yeah, so it's happening all along the riverfront in Cincinnati and Newport. Cincinnati, the riverfront parks there, Sawyer Point, Yeatman's Cove, and the Public Landing. And there are also several other sites like the Freedom Center's involved. I think they're going to have free admission this weekend, if I'm not mistaken. And along the Purple People Bridge, there'll be things happening. Newport Festival Park, Ovation, just kind of sites all along the river on both sides of the river downtown.
Yeah. This runs through Sunday, right? I think I'm remembering that correctly. And you have details on our website about parking and public transportation. People can find that on WVXU.org. Is it hard to park around there when you went down there?
I went at the middle of the day on a Wednesday. So, you know, it wasn't prime parking time, but yeah, there was certainly no shortage of parking. And you can always take the Metro bus or tank if you're worried about that.
Yeah. Now, I know one of these gentlemen you talked to you about tall stacks. I don't think it's a secret to our listeners that you are significantly younger than I am. But had you ever been to tall stacks? Have you ever heard of tall stacks before you went to report on this?
No, I think the final tall stacks happened when I was 4 and I was not living in Cincinnati at that time. So tragically, I've never experienced a tall stacks, but I've definitely heard tales. And it seems to live large in the city's memory. A lot of the people I went down to talked about it. One person even showed off a tall stacks backpack, which I was really impressed that they still had.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, good job keeping that backpack nice. Okay. You mentioned these ladies who were wearing these Regency dresses. Were there a lot of people in kind of period clothing, or were they the standouts when you were there?
Not necessarily period clothing, but it did seem like the historic nature of steamboats and also the cities of origin, the places that these steamboats were coming from, were inspiring a lot of people to kind of dress up. The Steamboat Natchez, which came from New Orleans and is offering these kind of themed cruises throughout the event, a lot of folks who were headed on there were kind of dressed in New Orleans-inspired attire. I saw one man wearing a fedora and a red and gold and green shirt with an alligator on it and lots of stuff. So not necessarily as historic of clothing as these women were dressed in, but no shortage of people dressing for the occasion.
Yeah. Okay, another question for you. Talk to us about the sounds of this event. I know the steamboats can make those big, woo, you know, that was my imitation. I know it was really impressive. Is there music? Like, what are the sounds that you hear there?
Yeah, it was really sound rich. And I've got to say, I'm not super familiar with all the sounds that a steamboat can make. But you're right, you know, as they're pulling out, they're blowing their horns. But I would say one of the more interesting pieces of the soundscape down there was steamboats playing their calliopes, which are like steam powered instruments aboard the boats. And they played songs and whatnot. So if you go down there, you'll definitely hear a lot of that.
Okay. Nick, did you ever go to Tall Stacks? Do you remember Tall Stacks back in the day?
I did not. Yeah, a little. I kind of before my time, I guess, but yeah.
I feel so old right now. So you never went. Okay. And Nick, I know you're a music guy. We talked about some of the acts that got canceled. If you could have picked the musical acts for the America's River Roots Festival, what kind of music do you think should have been there?
A 48-hour rendition of Proud Mary just the whole time piped throughout downtown until everybody went crazy.
Wow. You're a rebel. That sounds kind of punk, Nick.
It would have to be like record setting, right? Like it would really put us on the map even more than we already are.
Record setting and with ears bleeding and people shouting. I mean, I love that song, but for 48 hours straight.
I think it could hold up for that long.
That's a lot. Okay. why Proud Mary? Just because of the rolling on the river?
It's a steamboat song. You
okay.
Know?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna get with you on that. I can get on board. Not for the 48 hours, but okay. Well, let's move to the important reporting you did this week, Nick, on Second Avenue. We've talked before on this program about this national landlord, Second Avenue. It owns more than 200 single-family homes in Cincinnati. It's being sued by some tenants. Remind us what that lawsuit's all about.
Yeah. So this lawsuit filed by four tenants alleges a range of things, mostly unfair lease conditions, some conditions in the houses that they rented were pretty bad, according to these tenants, and kind of various other fees and things like that weren't right or weren't legal. That's sort of the core of this lawsuit, is these series of things that the company wasn't doing that were in line with Ohio law, allegedly.
Okay. What has the company said in its response to the lawsuit?
So Second Avenue filed last month this sort of, you know, notice saying, hey, we're going to defend ourselves vigorously. We didn't do anything wrong. But also we're going to be reaching out to our tenants and making sure that we pay them back for the charges that we committed. And we're also going to be giving them new leases that they can choose to sign that have some of these provisions stricken from them.
Huh. Okay.
So an interesting move on Second Avenue's part.
Yeah. So and it was like offering refunds for late fees, stuff like
right.
that. And is that so? But that's not an admission that they did something wrong. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't quite get that.
I am also not an attorney. So it's like I said, an interesting move. They are just saying, you know, if we overcharge people, we will pay them back.
Okay.
And they're saying they're reaching out to tenants now to kind of settle that. Now, the attorneys who filed the lawsuit on behalf of these tenants, they kind of filed back saying, this kind of proves our point, right? Like, this is like, you're saying you're not going to do these things and that you're going to make up for doing them. Those are the very things we sued you for. So there's some back and forth going on about, you know, culpability here.
Yeah, yeah. How does Second Avenue characterize the way its tenants feel about the company? Because these tenants who sued clearly are unhappy. What is the company saying about how their tenants feel about them?
So in their filing last month, they noted that they have about a 70% renewal rate for their tenants, lease renewal rate, and then they have this sort of like rating that the tenants do in their app that they use to pay their rent and things like that, and they say that rating is also very high, 4.6 out of 5 stars. So they're saying, hey, listen, most of our tenants seem like they're happy.
You, I know, talked with tenants who are involved in the lawsuit. You talked with others who aren't part of the lawsuit. Tell us what you heard from tenants.
Sure. Yeah, I went around to Second Avenue properties in Evanston, Avondale, College Hill, Spring Grove Village, North Fairmount, and some other neighborhoods, and just kind of knocked on doors and chatted with folks and trying to get a feeling of how they feel about where they're living. And a couple folks, I think like two folks said, hey, I haven't had any problems. I've been here about a year, both of them, and they've left me alone and I'm happy with how things are going. So there's that.
Yeah.
A lot of other folks had different stories. Without me kind of prompting, they talked about fees they didn't get from other landlords, sometimes like pretty excessive late fees they felt like were excessive. But then others had other issues that were a little bit more serious, maintenance issues. Conditions of some of these properties did seem to be pretty rough, and that's backed up by city code, like complaints as well. Things like HVAC systems not working, sewage backups, ceilings, that are collapsed in. So there's a whole range of issues that I heard from tenants who aren't involved in the lawsuits.
Okay. We've been talking about this lawsuit that was filed by tenants, but there's another lawsuit filed by the city and the Cincinnati Board of Health. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so this is a public nuisance lawsuit from the city and the Board of Health. And basically what they're saying is the condition of some of Second Avenue's properties just isn't up to code. And there's been, sort of multiple efforts to get them to get it up to code, and it hasn't happened. So the city claims that Second Avenue owes them about $137,000 in past due fines related to building and health code violations. And then they also, Waterworks, a couple thousand dollars in unpaid water bills, because I guess the conditions of the lease are that the Second Avenue is paying the water.
Okay.
So those are some serious issues. And I did dive into some of these code complaints in some of the houses that I visited, and there are some significant issues. Some of them get dealt with over time. It might take a while. Others, when I looked, were still open.
Mm-hmm. Has Second Avenue responded to that lawsuit at all?
Not that I've seen yet, no. I just checked today in the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts records, and I haven't seen a response from Second Avenue about that one. Now, there might be a day or two delay, so maybe we'll see something soon.
Yeah. What's next with these cases? I know we've just talked about a couple different cases, and these things can move kind of slowly. What do you expect to happen next with these?
Well, in both the public nuisance suit and in the lawsuit filed by the tenants, they're requesting a jury trial to get damages and things like that. Meanwhile, Second Avenue is taking that aforementioned step of reaching out to tenants and trying to, I guess, make right whatever might have been wrong. So, we'll see where it goes from there. I haven't seen any new filings from Second Avenue yet. I don't know if they're going to try to get this dismissed based on what they've already done, or if, there's some other strategy at play. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, Nick, as the long-form reporter here at WVXU, you do such a great job of following important stories over a long period of time, like you've been with these lawsuits, other landlords that have been sued by the city or tenants. But I want to switch gears a little bit. And another story you followed over the long term is the story of this cyclist in Covington who died after being hit by a car. I think this was several years ago. And there's a new development in that story. Can you remind us about this cyclist and kind of tell us what's happened there?
Yeah, Gloria Semegel was riding her bike with her partner across the 11th Street Bridge or 12th Street Bridge, depending on whether you're in Newport or Covington, in August 2022. When a driver hit and killed her. He drove off, eventually turned himself in, and was sentenced to 10 years in prison for that. But in the meantime, city officials and I think the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet talked about putting protected bike lanes on that bridge. And it took a while, but that is happening. The Kentucky Transportation Cabinet announced this week that they're starting work on that. So that should be done in the next couple weeks, I think, or maybe a month, something like that.
Yeah. And that's a bridge that crosses the Licking River. I have to say, I drive on that bridge pretty regularly. It's not a good bridge for pedestrians, in my humble opinion. I guess I'm editorializing but there are these skinny little sidewalks just raised just a little bit above the roadway. I think it's a four-lane bridge.
That's correct. Yeah.
So how are they going to divvy it up for these protected bike lanes?
So it will go down to one lane of traffic, vehicular traffic each way, and then there will be a bike lane on each side that kind of takes up what is now a vehicular lane on both sides, and there'll be a buffer in between the two.
Okay.
And they're doing this in conjunction with the 4th Street Bridge, which is the other bridge across the Licking kind of further north, that that is going to be closed as they make a replacement for that bridge.
Mm-hmm. And I thought you mentioned there's going to be some kind of buffer between the bike lane and the vehicle lane, because for people who've driven on that bridge for forever, I can see it, people just driving in those bike lanes.
Oh, sure, yeah. The Transportation Cabinet says they're going to have vertical elements, which I assume means bollards, which are, maybe that's a technical term people don't know, but the little plastic things that stick up, they stick up about, you know, a couple feet. So there will be something to mark off, hey, this is, don't drive your car here.
Mm-hmm. And you said that work should start just a couple months, you said?
The work is starting this week.
Oh, okay.
I think it actually started yesterday, and it won't take very long to finish, apparently.
So, okay. Yeah. Well, great. Well, I always appreciate you all being here. I've been talking with WVXU environment reporter Isabel Nisley and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
I want to remind everybody, if you missed our candidate interviews with all the Cincinnati City Council candidates, check them out on our website, wvxu.org. We also will be interviewing Mayor Aftab Purval about his reelection campaign. That'll be on the show Tuesday. We've extended an invitation to Corey Bowman, his Republican opponent, to be with us. Haven't heard back from him. The invitation still stands. I hope we do hear back from him. But tune in Tuesday to hear from the mayor. Up next, we're going to talk about the Bengals. The Bengals' new quarterback is an old quarterback. Is he friend or foe? Will he help the team? We'll talk to Richard Skinner from Local 12 about that and hear what he has to say. This is Cincinnati Edition. Stay with us because we'll be right back with some good stuff on the Bengals. The Cincinnati Bengals have a new Joe at the quarterback position. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me to talk about the trade that's giving some fans hope while others are giving the Bengals flack is Local 12 sports anchor and host of the Skinny podcast, Richard Skinner. Welcome back, Skinny.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Skinny, the Bengals' new quarterback is a veteran quarterback. Tell us about Joe Flacco. What does he bring to the mix?
A lot of experience. 18th year in the NFL. He's 40 years old. He's a big guy, 6'6". He's got a huge arm. That's the thing I think they're counting on, is that arm has not aged. Maybe the rest of his body has. Spent part of his career, big chunk of his career, with the Baltimore Ravens from 2008 to 2018. He won a Super Bowl, was the Super Bowl MVP in 2012, then spent a year in Denver in 2019, 3 years with the Jets. Then in 2023, he was literally on his couch not playing, and the Cleveland Browns called because they were desperate for a quarterback, and he led them to the playoffs that year. Then was with Indianapolis last year, back with the Browns this year. In fact, played against the Bengals in the opener. So he's been around, but they're counting on that big arm overcoming everything.
You mentioned he's 40 years old. That seems young to me, but old for a quarterback. I mean, is it? Several Bengal players have talked about being fans of his when they were just kids.
Yes, no. I mean, it's part of that locker room. The guys were 4 and 5 years old when he started his career. Think about that for a second. In fact, when the Bengals play the Steelers this Thursday, it'll be the second oldest starting quarterback combination in NFL history, because Aaron Rodgers is also 40 years old. Tom Brady was 45. Drew Brees was 42 when they played against each other. So by NFL standards, 40 is ancient.
Well, and the Bengals are planning to start him right away, right? Does that surprise you at all?
Yes. Yes and no. You know, when we talked to Zach Taylor on Monday, he talked about, you know, he hadn't made a decision on the starting quarterback yet, that he wanted whoever was going to start to take the the reps starting on Wednesday because they really only have two practices and a walkthrough in a given week. So whoever was going to start was going to take the reps on Wednesday. And desperate times call for desperate measures. And this was a desperate move. This was a very desperate move. And if you're going to go ahead and make the desperate move, you plug him in and start him. He's a smart guy. It's funny. I don't know if you've heard the story, but he got traded and he and his wife had a couple hours to pack up their apartment. The Bengals actually sent a driver for him. He did not fly from Cleveland to here. They drove him here. And during the trip, he spent a chunk of it on the phone with Zach Taylor going over stuff. So he hit the ground literally, I guess, sitting in a car, but hit the ground running.
Hit the ground rolling, at least, it sounds like.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, the Bengals beat the Browns when Joe Flacco was playing for the Browns earlier this season. What should we make of that?
He actually played okay. He was 31 of 45 for 290 yards. He did throw two interceptions, but both of those are credited to him. But both of them went off wide receivers' hands and ricocheted into Bengals defensive backs' hands. So while he gets debited, I guess, for the two interceptions, they really weren't his fault. But they only scored 16 points, too. So the Browns' offense sputtered, but he also didn't have the weapons in Cleveland he has in Cincinnati. I mean, probably his best weapon was the tight end, David Njoku. The wide receivers are not very good. Here in Cincinnati, as we know, the wide receivers are good. Jamar Chase is arguably the best in the NFL, and T. Higgins is probably in the top 20, top 25. So these are probably the best wide receivers he's thrown to in his entire career.
Huh. How important will it be for the Bengals' offensive line to protect this Joe? I mean, do you think they can do it?
Great question. It's one of the worst in the league. I think it's 30th in pass rush win rate. Means that they're losing a lot of battles up front. I'm going to guess they're going to have to change some things, where you keep a running back in, maybe even keep a tight end in. You don't send five guys out on the route and have your offensive linemen have to block one-on-one. You know, you'll have a couple of double teams. You're going against arguably one of the best pass rushers in the league, Micah Parsons. So that makes it even doubly tough because he's just outstanding. He lines up all over the place. So I'm going to guess their protection plan will be very much to keep as many in as they can. You'll probably see even a lot of times just two wide receivers go out on routes, and that's Jamar Chase and T. Higgins, and hope that Flacco can get rid of it. The one thing he does do well, he does process pretty well. I mentioned he's faced Green Bay already this season. They Browns won that game 13-10. It's their only win, so it's not like that was an offensive juggernaut day, but he has seen them, so he's already got a leg up in preparation for this team. That helps a lot. But the offensive line's got to step up. It has not played well at all. Orlando Brown, who they signed a couple of years ago, was a Pro Bowl caliber player when they signed him. He got hurt last year, and he just has not looked the same. You got a rookie at right guard. We don't know who the left guard is going to be this week because of a guy returning from injury, Lucas Patrick, and another guy, Dylan Fairchild, who's been starting, who's hurt and doesn't look like he's going to be able to play. And right tackle Amarius Mims is still a work in progress in his second year. So, yeah, they're going to have to come up with a really good protection plan for Joe, because I just don't think you go, can the offensive line do it, because they haven't done it.
Okay, this might be a dumb question, but if Joe Flacco is so good, why were the Browns willing to give him up? And do you think this gives fans hope, or are fans ready to just throw in the towel?
No, I think it gives you some hope just because Jake Browning had played so poorly. But this move isn't anything other than a desperate move. I mean, they were desperate for anything different at quarterback, and Flacco was the most logical guy. They think he fits the system and all of those things. This isn't the Joe Flacco who played in the late 2000s and early 2010s. This is a 40-year-old Joe Flacco who's bounced around. And to your point, you know, teams don't trade with teams inside their division very often, if at all. And the Browns were willing to do that. So that also is a little bit of – I mean, there's a lot of red flags here, Lucy. Don't get me wrong. I don't want fans to get the false hope that Joe Flacco is close to being what Joe Burrow is. You're just hoping you can get a little mileage out of him to keep you afloat in really an AFC North that's not very good this year.
What does this move mean for Jake Browning? Does he still have a future with the Bengals?
I don't think we've seen the last of him this year because, to your point of the offensive line, if – Joe Burrow does not come back from that toe injury this year, I can't see Joe Flacco playing every game because I just don't think he's going to hold up health-wise. So I don't think we've seen the end of Jake Browning. I don't think we'll see him beyond this season. It just was a real struggle. And it really, after the game Sunday, he was, you could just tell his performances were just in his head completely. Like, he was a scrambled mess. He's a great kid. I think everybody who covers the team, myself included, we're rooting for Jake because he's a really good kid, and this was a great opportunity. And if he had played well, he probably was going to get paid by another team next year, even though the Bengals still would retain his rights and probably would have kept him, I guess. But no, I don't think we've seen the end of him this year because he is the backup. And I don't think Flacco will hold up, to be honest with you. I mean, it might be a three-game disastrous stretch for Joe Flacco, and you just say, you know, to heck with it, we'll go back to Jake Browning. I think this is a – if nothing else, Lucy, this is going to be interesting to watch. There were a couple of us on the beat that on Sunday, there's a handful of us driving together to go to stay in Milwaukee and then drive to Green Bay the day of the game because we couldn't find flights that were very good. And so a guy turned to me, who's from another outlet, and said, dude, do you really want to go next week? I go, I don't know, man. Let's talk about it early in the week. And as soon as they signed or traded for Flacco, we're like, well, this just made it interesting, so let's do it. Let's go ahead and go. So it will be at least interesting.
Worth the drive now. So what do you think the Bengals' chances are with Flacco against Green Bay? You mentioned that he beat him, you know, earlier this season. What will you be watching for most closely?
They need the defense to step up. As I mentioned, you know, the Cleveland beat Green Bay 13-10, so that was obviously a defensive struggle. I don't think this Bengals' defense is good enough to hold anybody to 10, but it does need to play better. I don't think you can expect Joe Flacco to go out and put up in the high 20s, low 30s points-wise. I'll be honest, it's so weird. This stretch was really pinned a lot on Jake Browning, and rightfully so. He did not play very well. But this was such a tough stretch, including this Green Bay game, that even if Joe Burrow had quarterbacked, I'm not so sure they would be anywhere different, to be quite frank. I think they would have a real possibility to be 2-4, which I think they will be after Sunday. But then you got three home games before the bye, the Thursday night Pittsburgh game, and then winnable games against the Jets, who are just simply awful, and the Chicago Bears before you take a bye. There's a realistic chance to be 5-4 at the bye, even if you lose this game. I think all you want to see is just some level of competency at the quarterback position, some improvement on defense, and say, okay, if this team plays that way against some lesser opponents at home, it can make some hay. And if you got to 5-4 at the bye, I'll be honest with you, I think if everybody does the thing at the beginning of the year that covers the team and goes, this game's a win, this game's a loss, I'll bet you most of us had them 5-4 at the bye. So through all the trials and tribulations and the struggles of Jake Browning and all of that, they still have a realistic chance to be where they probably should be at the bye.
Well, I've been talking with Local 12 sports anchor and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you missed our interviews with Cincinnati City Council candidates, you can find the audio and transcripts on WVXU.org. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.